listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's hard enough to craft a two-year state budget during, quote, normal times, but how about during a pandemic? We'll look at the challenges facing state programs because of COVID-19 coming up. Now, a broad voting rights and election reform bill known as H.R. 1 passed the House of Representatives on Wednesday with almost all Democrats voting in favor. The bill would establish automatic voter registration, mandate nonpartisan redistricting commissions, require more transparency in campaign donations, and more. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said on the steps of the Capitol last week that the bill is needed as Republicans are considering voting restrictions on the state level around the country.
We must win this race, this fight for this bill, because it at the same time as we are gathering here to honor our democracy across the country, over 200 bills are being put together, provisions are putting forth to suppress the vote.
The bill faces a tougher road in the U.S. Senate. It would need the support of all Democrats and probably changes to the filibuster rule. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think are the most important voting issues facing the country right now? Should we be thinking about protecting and expanding access or limiting it? What do you think about the voting rights bill that just passed the House? If you support it, would it be worth eliminating the filibuster if that's what it took to pass? And you have questions about what all this stuff does? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lana Atkison is a professor of political science and director of the Center for the Study of Voting, Elections, and Democracy at the University of New Mexico. Lana, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, this is coming out of the 2020 elections. And before we go to this federal reform effort, can you talk about what you're seeing at the state level with lots and lots of changes being proposed in the works in state legislatures to the way we vote?
Right. We're seeing a sort of unusual set of bills being put forth in states across the country that are sort of pulling back at least some of the things that happened during COVID, in some cases pulling back from some other things that they had put forward before.
This federal legislation, before we get into the specifics, one big overarching change is it would insert the federal government into state election systems substantially more than it has been in the past. Usually this is left up to states to determine how voting happens. How big a change would this be?
Well, this would be a really big change because it would be a uniform system of voting for federal elections. And that's probably an important first step if we want to move to some sort of national popular vote, because the election laws are so different across states that there's equal protection issues. So this is probably, you know, if we want to move towards that, this is probably a good first step. That doesn't mean that all of the provisions in the bill are good or that I personally like them, but it does mean that thinking about what kinds of things we'd want in a national election, what kinds of things we'd want to be consistent across states, what we need to have consistent to create equal protection is an important discussion to start having.
Let's look at some of the specific changes now in this bill that passed the House. An automatic voter registration system in every state. What do you think of that idea? How would it work?
You know, a number of states have AVR systems. They usually use state agencies. This would expand that to universities and colleges as well. They would be required to give people the option to vote. Actually, it's an opt-out process, so everybody gets the option to participate, and they actually have to say that they want to opt out to get opt out. So it would definitely increase voter registration across the country.
And then there's the idea of nonpartisan redistricting commissions. This is an issue here in Wisconsin, of course, and many other states. Accusations that whichever party draws the map gerrymanders the districts. This would be a big change. How would redistricting be handled in states under this bill?
You know, that's really hard to tell. We don't have a lot of states at the time that have independent redistricting commissions. I think in the last cycle, there was maybe only one state that really had it, and it didn't really turn out to show any differences. So the literature so far doesn't seem to suggest that this is a panacea to the problem, but maybe there would be some benefits from that. I think that you need some sort of guideposts about, you know, what a commission should do. Is it looking for creating contiguous districts? Is it, you know, contiguous areas and making sure that, you know, natural barriers are kept together? Or is it about creating more competitive districts, which might end up making districts looking really weird and not kept together? So there needs to be some mandates and thinking about what that would look like under the hood.
Another change that's gotten a lot of attention, the bill would require more transparency on political donations. So in effect, if I have a political group that's spending political money in certain ways, I might have to disclose my donors. And I know that's been opposed by groups on the right and on the left in the past. What do you think of that that change?
Yeah, you know, from my personal perspective, I think that disclosure is a good thing. You know, people should have to disclose who they're supporting and how they're giving their political money. So that seems like a really basic idea to me. I think the bill itself has sort of these rather high limits of $10,000 or more that you have to spend. So it wouldn't include small donors. So I'm not sure that it's quite expansive enough in terms of shedding the light.
We're talking to Lana Atkison, professor of political science at the University of New Mexico, looking at H.R. 1, this big set of proposals to change voting rules in the country past the U.S. House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a change you want to see, a change you don't want to see? Do you want the federal government stepping in and giving more guidance or taking authority away from states when it comes to setting rules of how we vote, when we vote, and that sort of thing? Call 800-642-1234. No Republican votes for this in the House, likely to be the case in the Senate, too. I want to give a listen to Senator Mike Lee of Utah talking on Fox News with his thoughts on the bill.
This is a bill as if written in hell by the devil himself. This takes all sorts of decisions that the federal government really has no business making. It takes them away from the states, makes them right here in Washington, D.C. by Congress.
And that's going to be, I think, a big point of opposition to this. As we said earlier, states have been in charge of this stuff. I think states, in many cases, want to stay in charge of this stuff. And a lot of people at the federal level will want to keep that. Lana, why can you talk about that argument that states should, in fact, keep authority over these decisions?
Well, you know, states are the place that where this has been for the last, you know, since the inception of the Republic. So it certainly has a long history that it's in state governments that decide these things. And states actually know their constituents and know their state, right? They know what their state has. So do you have enough connectivity, for example, in your state to have same day registration everywhere to ensure that there's no problems with processing someone's vote and not putting it into a provisional vote? So there is, you know, a long history, and there is the fact that legislators know their states and they know their constituents and they know the intricacies of what's going on in those states. And so that does mean that they have are better suited to understanding the needs for both access and integrity to the ballot.
I know the 15th Amendment says, hey, states, you can't discriminate on the basis of race when it comes to voting. And hey, Congress, you have the authority to step in when states do that. I don't know. How much does that constitutionally empower Congress to say, hey, yeah, no, we do need to set some of these policies at the federal level?
Well, the federal government has the right to set the standards for federal elections. So, you know, there could be, this could create a two-tiered system, I guess, theoretically, where you'd have one set of rules for federal elections, one set of rules for state elections. I mean, theoretically, you could have states put their state elections at different times than federal elections. They don't have to be every 2 years for other kinds of down ballot offices in the state. So, you know, it could, you know, but certainly the Congress, right, has the opportunity and the right to set parameters for congressional elections and for federal elections.
We're talking to Lana Atkison, director of the Center for the Study of Voting, Elections, and Democracy at the University of New Mexico. We're looking at H.R. 1, the voting and elections bill that's passed the House and now heads to the Senate. Good chance it won't pass there under current rules anyway. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of some of the items in this bill? Automatic voter registration, nonpartisan redistricting. Do you want to see the Senate pass this, even if it required getting rid of the filibuster? Do you think the federal government should set more standard rules for how states run their elections, or should it be up to states like Wisconsin to write the rules? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Lana Atkison, professor of political science at the University of New Mexico, looking at the H.R. 1 voting bill that passed the U.S. House this week and what it would mean for how we run elections if, big if, the Senate signs off on it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there changes you'd like to see to the way we do elections in Wisconsin and around the country? Whether or not they're in this bill, what do you think needs to change, if anything? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Let's go to your calls now. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. So I was reading about this bill today, and I think it has some I'm in support of pretty much everything in the bill. I think whether or not this passes, goes through the Senate, I think this bill or something like it is necessary to maintain the health of our democracy. The federal government, I think, at this point needs to step in and say all these things, all these impediments and roadblocks that are being put up to registration and to voting, things like ID laws, getting rid of same-day registration, other changes need to stop. I think that this is a good thing, and I think that this should pass. Whether it does or not is another question, but I think the federal government stepping in is a good thing. I think they should take the lead from this and do more, like maybe revamp on the unemployment system. So,
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Lana, Michael's worried that the changes that we're seeing in states will bring about unfair impediments to being able to vote. Are you concerned about that, looking at the various, and there's a lot of different ones, laws proposed around the country?
You know, I mean, in some cases, it might affect things a little bit. In other cases, it's probably not going to affect things too much. You know, a lot of people voting is a fairly easy thing to do. It's fairly accessible to most voters. That doesn't mean there aren't any impediments or they're not cost to voters. But for example, what we've seen most recently with voter ID cases is that states that have implemented them, they've seen sort of this backlash of effect, which has actually increased voter participation. So sometimes things don't work out like you think, and maybe they're mobilizing effects and not demobilizing effects to them. So I always think, be careful what you wish for. You never know what's going to happen. So I don't think they would have a lot of effects. They might have, you know, marginal effects.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Rosa is with us in Waterford. Rosa, hi.
Hello. So, two things. One, my concern with this automatic registration, how will it weed out people that are not qualified to vote, non-citizens, say? Secondly, it's interesting. I'm in Wisconsin, and I received two mail-in ballots that I did not request. So this was the first year ever there was a mail-in ballot, which is different than the absentee ballot. Absentee is what you request. I'm curious to know if this new proposal in H.R. 1, which I'm against, will kind of have that mail-in ballot mentality where we'll send it to everyone and we won't check to see if you're qualified or not, or how many households receive this this ballot. Because I think that's why we had more votes than people voted for, because people received 2-3 ballots in the household.
Rosa, thanks a lot for the call. And I'll correct that. We did not have more votes in Wisconsin than people who voted or could vote. There was a lot of misinformation going on around about that. But Lana, to her points, first of all, a concern about automatic voter registration, registering people who aren't eligible to vote.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the provisions in the bill are about that. I do know that there are provisions so that if people who are not eligible to vote do get registered, that it's no fault of their own and that it can't be held against them. So I do know that that's in the bill. I don't know how, it was actually one of my questions, how they go about sort of sifting through to make sure ineligible voters aren't on the rolls. There is no, on her second question, though, that it would not allow for universal mail-in voting, where we would just, every state would mail out ballots to everyone and then send them back. Absentee rules for ballot requests would still be part of the process in those states that have that. There are states that where you can become on a permanent early voting list, but it would not mandate that. It would mandate that all states have the opportunity for no excuse voting, which many, you know, a bunch of states actually don't do that. In fact, New York, for example, until COVID happened, didn't have no excuse voting. A lot of the older states that came into the union early didn't have those kinds of rules and changed them for COVID. Some of them have kept them, like New York City. They've changed all their New York State. Other places like Massachusetts just made it a special case for COVID, but they're not going to continue with that. So,
thanks for calling in, Rosa. We'll go to Andy now in Manitowoc. Andy, hello.
Yes, I just wanted to say that isn't this HR1 taking the state's rights away and basically saying that by federalizing it, we are giving more power to the federal government and taking it away from our local government, which, as I've heard in all my civics days, is that local government is where you want most of the power or authority to lie, since it's the local people that should be doing this rather than some central government in Washington.
Andy, thanks for the call. Thanks a lot for the call, Andy. Alana, I mean, this would definitely shift the balance of election power to the federal government if it were passed. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. This is definitely a move to federalize and make consistent rules across states.
Thanks a lot for that call. And I wanted to ask you, Lana, if something like this were to pass, and again, tall order in the Senate, but could states or would states, do you think, be likely to sue then the federal government saying, hey, no, you don't get to take this authority away from us?
Oh, absolutely. States would. There'd be some sort of lawsuit among many states pushing back on, you know, federalization of the elections.
Let's go to Peter now in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I haven't read everything, so I can't say I agree with everything in the bill, but you mentioned something about earlier about who knows if then states would hold their own elections at a different time. And that got me thinking, even if there were nonpartisan redistricting, would the states then possibly be able to make their own districts for state office?
Interesting, Peter. Thanks for the call. So, yeah, if it affected federal, would we have different districts at the state and federal levels, I guess, Lana?
Yeah, we could. I mean, we already have different levels at the state level because it's just a different number of legislative sure. seats and all of that kind of stuff. So we definitely, and so you could have the state legislature do one and the independent redistricting commission do the one for the federal races. That is completely a possibility that states could do if that were to happen.
Peter, thanks for that call. We'll bring on Dave now, calling from Sussex. Dave, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I got two quick points. Number one, we are the United States of America. The state's rights to do what they will within their own state laws is imperative to the freedom and the liberties of our country. That's number one. Tyranny comes from the top. Keep your hands off our state's rights. Number two, HR1 is a horrible bill designed to cheat. You talk about fair and honest elections. Let's have a fair and honest election. Let's get rid of early voting and all this other crap. Mail-in voting is the worst thing you could possibly do. Quit being deceitful and dishonest about this bill. Shame on you.
Dave, I'm not sure who the you was in that sentence, but Dave, worried, as others are, that HR1 and early voting, mail-in voting, make cheating in elections easier. Lana, do they?
Well, it's certainly true that there's this tension between access and integrity in elections, and every time you sort of increase the access, you increase the opportunity for more fraud. And although we don't see a lot of fraud in elections, where we do see fraud, it does happen to be in absentee balloting more often than in in-person voting. You know, I think that early voting is really a critical thing to think about for states and localities as they, you know, as elections continue to change and grow. It really relieves pressure on election day. A lot of people like to vote early because they can't go on Tuesdays to vote. And so it increases people's options. You know, I'm a real proponent of, you know, early voting. I think it really decreases the lines on election days. So there's a lot of really positive things about early voting.
As we wrap up, Lana, I think it can be tough to rewrite election laws, maybe even ones that everybody would agree on, because there's always going to be the suspicion, is this going to benefit you, the other side, more than it does me and my side? Does that make it tough to come up with reasonable changes to our election laws?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, people, you know, especially if it's not a bipartisan bill. I mean, I think that this is really important legislation to think about and to move forward, but we really need to move forward in a bipartisan way on that. It may not be possible. So, you know, that's going to be a problem, but it needs to be a bill that considers the needs and perceptions of both sides in the voting process, because really an election needs to be built so that the losers feel that there's a lot of integrity in it. And that's something we need to keep in mind as we move forward.
Lana, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Lana Atkison is professor of political science and director of the Center for the Study of Voting, Elections, and Democracy at the University of New Mexico. She joined us for a look at what's in the Voting and Elections Bill passed this week by the U.S. House and waiting for it to be tackled by the U.S. Senate, where it's expected to face a much tougher struggle. Coming up, we'll take a look at the fiscal challenges facing the state as a result of the pandemic and what Governor Evers' proposed budget and or state lawmakers may do about them. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin is getting a nice dose of spring-like weather this week. We want to hear how you've been enjoying it. Now, the Republican-controlled Joint Finance Committee announced this week that it'll hold four public hearings on the new state budget. Three of them will be in person in Whitewater, Rhinelander, and Menominee. One will be virtual. All of them will happen in April. After that, lawmakers will start debating the budget. Governor Evers released his proposal last month, but leading lawmakers say they will likely start from scratch. The governor's budget plan calls for boosting school spending by $1.6 billion, expanding Medicaid benefits to more than 90,000 people, pumping $200 million toward broadband access, and another $200 million to help businesses recover from COVID-19. The Wisconsin Policy Forum took a look at how the pandemic has upended state programs and how Evers' proposals and whatever comes out of the legislature could affect them. Jason Stein is Wisconsin Policy Forum's research director. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob.
Give us a sense, Jason, of how COVID has disrupted the state's finances in general.
Well, that's a really interesting question, I think. When you look at many of these programs, they're seeing these swings that you just haven't seen in a long time or haven't seen, period. Within the Medicaid program from December 19 to December 2020, we saw nearly 18% rise in participants. Within the state prison population, that dropped nearly 17%. School enrollment decreased by about 4%. That doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a huge drop when you're talking about all our K-12 schools in Wisconsin. It's tens of thousands of students. So to give you a sense of the scale, the governor has a controversial proposal to expand Medicaid using federal money. That add about 90,000 people to the program. but the COVID impact has already added December to December, roughly 211,000, Rob. So it's more than double the impact of this proposal that the governor has already just from, you know, the impact of the pandemic and unemployment.
Now, one kind of surprising in some ways bit of good news, the state's in better financial shape than we were projecting, say, a year ago when everything was shutting down. A lot of state revenue was drying up. Where are we now?
Yeah, that's true. And so when you look back to where we thought we would be maybe in May or June, which was not the worst months of the pandemic, but were sort of, I think, some of the worst economic fears at that time. Since then, you know, state tax collections have held up relatively well, particularly corporate tax collections have been very strong for a variety of reasons we've written about. We've had federal relief funds and we've had targeted state spending cuts. And so you add all those things together, and we're really heading into this next budget in a relatively strong place fiscally. Now, obviously, many, many people in the state are hurting, and that puts a lot of pressure on state officials. But when you just look at the state's books, for now, we're holding up pretty well. And obviously, this American Rescue Plan has billions of dollars for state and local governments. So that's a big impact as well.
Talking to Jason Stein from the Wisconsin Policy Forum, looking at a new analysis of some key issues facing the governor and state lawmakers as they craft our new two-year budget for the state. We've hit, Jason, on a couple of the points you raised in that report. Another one you're looking at has to do with educational equity. And we know this was already a concern in Wisconsin, educational outcome gaps, racial disparities, and more. And now here comes the pandemic and learning from home and that being a bigger challenge for some students and some schools than others. What kind of challenges does that raise in the new budget?
Well, I mean, that is one of my biggest concerns as a parent and just as a citizen is the impact on students, particularly vulnerable students, of this pandemic and the loss of in-person classroom teaching. I mean, to the degree that we believe that funding and equipping a public school system of in-person instruction is meaningful, I would have to think that the loss of it or the impairment of it is meaningful as well. And we really haven't seen good data on that. And that's something that, in my view, we desperately need. But to look at the state's funding, you know, it's going to be a question of how much money does the state deliver from its own tax dollars to schools? How much under state revenue limits are they going to let schools spend? And how are they going to distribute the money? Is it going to be on a flat per pupil basis, as many Republicans' budgets have done in recent years? Is it going to be more through the state's funding formula or through certain aids that are targeted to specific categories of students? The governor has his proposal, but obviously the legislature is going to rewrite it considerably.
Now, looking at local governments, Jason, I know I've seen national reports on how states at the state government level, like Wisconsin, are doing better than expected. Do we have a sense for the city governments, the county governments, the towns, how much the pandemic has affected them?
You know, for both cities and school districts headed into the pandemic with relatively strong reserves, they are certainly going to benefit from the federal aid. You know, I think it remains to be seen to some degree, but I think, you know, so far they've held up relatively well. You know, certain areas have, like transit, have been hit incredibly hard, but have also received a lot of federal aid that, you know, so far has enabled them to sort of hold up under the strain relatively well. So, I mean, that's certainly something that we'll be looking at the Milwaukee and Madison school district budgets here in the spring. And a lot of our school districts have held referenda successfully, and that has been a boost to them. And we'll see more in the fall. But I think, you know, so far, again, I don't want to diminish the the real challenges that are out there, but things are better than I think we would have expected back in, say, May or June.
Now, looking at Governor Evers' budget proposal, it would increase overall spending in the neighborhood of 10% or so. Again, state lawmakers are probably not going to use that budget as their building block. But just looking at that raw number, that increase in funding, how do you see that affecting the state's financial well-being?
The increase in funding for?
In the overall budget, not just one category, but the whole price tag.
Sure. Well, you know, obviously the governor wants some tax decreases, but, you know, on balance, a net increase of about $1 billion, with that coming from upper income earners, certain manufacturers, and federalizing our tax code to be more like what the IRS uses. Republicans are very, very unlikely to do that, Rob. So there's a lot of that money, that spending, out of the budget. The governor wants to expand Medicaid. We initially thought that would bring in an additional, or free up an additional, $630 million in state tax dollars over the next 2 years. Now, under this American Rescue Plan, that appears to add an additional $1 billion on top of that. So, but again, as we're talking about, the Medicaid expansion is unlikely for Republicans to go for that. So when you start to pull some of those things out of the budget, you pull out a lot of the spending. I think what it remains to be seen is what happens with state reserves. Under the governor's proposal, they would have really fallen considerably, maybe around $1.7 billion over the 2 years. The loss of those reserves is in some ways understandable given the pandemic and the economic crisis. At the same time, they're an important thing to watch, because to the extent that the state undergoes further troubles, they're a source of strength and can be used to sort of fill gaps. So, you know, one thing that I'll be watching is, do the Republicans use about the same? Do they use more because they could also dip into the rainy day fund, or do they use less? And, you know, that's something that we'll have to see in the coming months.
And it seems like Governor Evers and then the Republican leaders in the legislature are coming from very different starting points on the budget. We don't have the specific plan from the legislature yet. Do you see areas where you think they're going to be able to work together and be on the same page?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, I think we can't even be certain necessarily that the legislature passes a bill that the governor will sign. Even with his ability to make a lot of partial vetoes. But, you know, we've talked about some of the areas where they're apart. You know, there may be some areas where they can come together. Rural schools, for example, the governor has done a number of things that would help rural schools. Many of those are represented by Republicans in the legislature, so they may be willing to do certain things like, you know, increasing some state aid, raising revenue limits, particularly the revenue limits for the lowest spending districts. You know, there are areas, you know, the governor has a lot of aid to small businesses. He has an enormous increase within the state's Economic Development Corporation to try and assist businesses impacted by the pandemic.
Are you still there, Jason?
Tax side, but maybe willing for spending there. And so that's some of the areas where they might come together.
We'll leave it there. Jason, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's Jason Stein, Research Director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. We talked to him today about how the pandemic has affected state programs and how Governor Evers' proposed two-year budget and what we're hearing so far from the Republican-led legislature would address those challenges. Coming up, we want to hear about how you've been enjoying the warmer, almost spring-like weather for most of this week. Have you gotten outside more? What kind of activities have you been up to? Call in now at 800-642-1234. More walks, riding the bike, firing up the grill, or maybe just enjoying not wearing a big heavy winter coat. Let us know now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll take your calls coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. President Biden will deliver what the White House calls his first primetime address tonight. We'll bring you live NPR coverage starting at 7. The address will mark 1 year since COVID-19 was declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization. Join us for live coverage tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Now it feels like spring is almost officially here in Wisconsin. The state has, for the most part, become less frozen. Birds like robins, geese, and sandhill cranes are flying back to town. And the sun is shining. Well, weather in Wisconsin can be a little fickle. We still wanted to take some time and appreciate the nice weather and ask you how you're taking advantage of the milder temperatures. Call in now at 800-642-1234. Have you done something a little extra special to get outside? What sort of activities are you able to do now that it's a little less frigid? Longer walks, bike rides, grilling, you name it. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Chippewa Falls. Jeff, hi.
Hi.
What have you been up to, Jeff?
I thought I'd call in. Well, a lot of our area golf courses are opening this weekend.
Ooh.
And some are already open. That would be in the Eau Claire, Chippewa Falls area.
And are you headed out there?
Well, not today. I guess Saturday they're supposed to open. It's just a matter of finding time because now that the snow and the ice is gone, now I have all this cleanup to do.
Oh, okay. Well, good luck. I hope you find time amidst the cleanup to get out golfing, Jeff. Thanks for getting us started at 800-642-1234 as we talk about ways to enjoy the warm up this week. 800-642-1234 is the number to share yours. And we asked around here at WPR, as we do from time to time. The big boss, Mike Crane, says, I've been walking in almost all weather, but now a favorite route is no longer snow covered. So this morning I walked it for the first time this year. And Mike says this past Tuesday, I did my first longer outdoor bike ride, a favorite lake loop around Lake Mendota. We also heard back from WPR Eau Claire regional manager Dean Kallenbach. He says he's going out to watch his honeybees start to venture out of the hive after a long, hard winter. Well, that sounds great. And then Central Region producer and outreach specialist Joy Ratch-Kramer says, I'm taking long walks at our local nature preserve. The trails are still a bit icy, but nothing I can't handle. As a bonus, I've already found some hidden kindness rocks. I don't know about that. What's a kindness rock? I'll have to look that up. How about you? How are you enjoying the warming up weather of almost spring in Wisconsin? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Or send a quick email, ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Maria is with us in Phillips. Maria, hello.
Hi. Yes, I'm calling. I've been doing maple syrup with some friends up in Phillips. It's been a great way to get out into the woods and see the snow melting.
Have you gone out and collected maple syrup before, or is this your first time?
Oh, no, this is my fifth season, and
they've been
doing it even longer than me.
Okay, and the weather's pretty good for it there?
Yeah, it is. A little bit warm, but it's going to freeze a little bit more tonight. So good time for just collecting some sap.
Is it running pretty good?
It is. We did our first cook. I made about 10 gallons and hoping that we can cook again later this weekend. We put in a normally like 1,600 taps, so it's a pretty big operation.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's not just a hobby. That's a, yeah. Maria, thank you so much for sharing that. Look forward to sharing some of that maple syrup with you, too. How about you? What are you up to with this warmer week in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Graham is with us now in Arlington. Graham, hi.
Hey, Rob. It's been a really nice week outside. I just got done putting up 3 wood duck boxes and 3 songbird boxes.
Ooh.
Earlier this week. First cranes, geese, white-fronted geese, all types of hawks and other stuff coming back. So a lot of activity outside right now.
And do you get out and, I mean, obviously you're making it so you can see them from your own yard. It sounds like, Graham, do you go out for nature walks and whatnot to see the birds coming back this time of year?
Yeah, definitely. Any place with open water is a good bet for this time of year with, fresh flocks of waterfowl and such like that. So that's some of the main thing that I'm seeking out right now is open water, little creeks and such like that.
Oh, that sounds nice. I like the creeks too. Before I let you go, Graham, what's the next bird you're hoping to see?
Oh, the next bird I'm hoping to see, probably the next push of weird ducks, maybe like pintails and wood ducks, and maybe we'll get some widgeon and whatnot in here pretty soon.
Sounds fantastic, Graham. Thanks for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Liam joins us next in Eau Claire. Liam, hi.
Hi.
What are you up to?
I have been running a lot more just with the warmer weather and being able to get outside. I've been running outside quite a bit more, which is very fun.
Now, through the winter, I've been getting out and walking when I can. I have a beat-up old treadmill I got for free for a while to keep me walking inside. Were you treading inside during the winter?
Yes, and it's not the same as running outside. It's so much more fresh air and more refreshing to run outside.
Fantastic. Well, I'm glad for you, Liam, being able to get back outside. We asked morning show host Kate Archer-Kent. She says the Kents are going on afternoon bear hunts a lot. Oh, that's just the code word for hikes in front of the house in the woods. Ever since they've lived there, they make sound much more adventurous and daring to lure the kids outdoors. She points out, we've never seen a bear. It's not truth in advertising living in Madison. Let's go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Marilyn is with us in Laval. Marilyn, hi.
Hi. I am able to hang out clothes again and go to bed with nice, fresh-smelling sheets.
Do you have to allow the sheets to warm up some first, though, Marilyn?
Actually, sometimes it's better when you get in there nice, crisp, and smell like fresh air.
I do like the fresh air smell, but yeah, and how are you? I don't know. My worry when it's this cold still is like, is this still wet or is it just really cold and it feels like it's wet? Are you able to tell the difference?
Yes. I mean, it's it was so windy the other day. It didn't take long at all. And they were, you know, it's actually better. The wrinkles are all out and they smell nice and fresh and they're soft and yeah.
Oh, that's a great time of year. Marilyn, thank you so much for sharing that. We are asking you to share how you have enjoyed the nicer outdoor weather this year here in Wisconsin. Still time if you want to get your call in. If you call quick, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We asked again around our WPR offices. WPR Human Resource Specialist Kate O'Connor says, I've been getting out with my kids. They were loving the nice sunny weather so they could run around and play outside. Well, I do that with my kids too, but they're 18. They don't want to run around and play. But they are getting outside. Central Time producer Colleen Leahy says, I stand in patches of sun for 5 to 10 minutes at a time, then go back inside, feeling slightly more alive. Colleen says, I'm looking forward to when it's warm enough to do some real hardcore outdoor lounging. That's probably more my speed than the running around, definitely. And Jeffrey Potter, Director of Marketing and Communications, says our daughter is 9, been enjoying getting together with a limited group of neighborhood friends outside, masked up and socially distanced through the pandemic. Now that the weather's warmed up, they're getting ready to draw, do sidewalk chalk, and other creative projects together. The sleds have been traded in for scooters. That's a good sign of changing times. Back to your calls now. Marcus is with us in Reedsburg. Marcus, hi.
How you doing?
All right. What are you getting out and doing, Marcus?
We're going to go shed hunting, looking for antlers.
Looking for shed antlers. I thought you were going to go hunting for sheds. And I'm like, they stand really still. Antlers that are shed, I get you.
Yeah, they're all over. The ones that are out in the woods are a little harder to find, but it's sure a lot of fun.
Yeah, and the paths are melted off enough so you're not walking through the icy kind of slop now, I hope.
Well, where we're going, it's not too bad. So.
Excellent. All right. Well, happy hunting, Marcus. Thanks for that. Time for one more call. Adele is with us in Madison. Adele, looks like Adele dropped. Are you there, Adele? Nope. Okay. Well, thank you. Probably didn't have time anyway, let's be honest. Thank you so much for all of your calls. Been fun to hear what's getting you outside now that things are warming up. Yeah, I've been doing longer walks, less heavily coated walks, and hang out on the back porch, too, in the late afternoons and evenings, which I've been looking forward to a lot through the winter. You can keep sharing your warmer weather outdoor activities this week. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Thanks again for all your calls. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, get advice and share your thoughts on being the parent of boys in the 21st century. Kate talks to the author of the new book, To Raise a Boy, Classrooms, Locker Rooms, Bedrooms, and the Hidden Struggles of American Boyhood. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then some people are saying Meghan Markle's revelation that she had suicidal thoughts could be helpful to those with mental health issues. We'll find out why and get some advice from a Wisconsin suicide expert that is coming up. Remember, you can take WPR with you wherever you go. Download the WPR app onto your phone, and then you can listen to us live, check out archives and much more, or use your old-fashioned computer and listen live at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.